Hi, with Truth News Radio Australia, and it is the 7th of February 2013 in Australia. Of course, if you're listening in the US, it's one day behind. And if you are listening in the US, a very, very warm welcome to you, wherever you may be. If you're driving, if you're listening to this show in Austin, Texas, or in Oklahoma City, do hope to be able to bring you some very original and insightful commentary on what's going on in the world today for you. Truth News Radio Australia is a global show, but we do emphasise stories related to Australia. And today, in the second hour, I actually have a really important story to bring to you, and a guest who's doing really important work for freedom, liberty, for the essence of what a free society is about. It's about how we treat children. Gabrielle Phillips Short is coming on to talk about an event that she has organised, a national rally titled the Forgotten Australians National Day of Action. Now, this is all about children who are in orphanages and foster care and under various forms of government supervision. And what has been happening to these kids over many years, over many decades, over many generations. And the stories she's going to bring are quite shocking. She herself was brought up in an orphanage. She is a victim of a variety of different forms of abuse. You know, there's all kinds of different types of abuse that happen to kids. There's the institutional sort of abuse of the system itself, which you could say, well, when we have a bureaucratic system, when it's impersonal, that is going to happen. And you might say, we have to put up with that. But it becomes so impersonal to the extent that the actual needs of people are not being met. What we have is really just a system that is treating people as if they are not really human beings. I mean, it doesn't address the concerns of parents. It doesn't address the needs of kids. And it goes to another level when the government authorities and the healthcare authorities are teaming up with large pharmaceutical corporations. And, of course, this is all under the rubric of government universal healthcare. When they team up with these pharmaceutical companies to test out drugs, and they have a fantastic pool of test subjects in the kids who are in foster care and orphanages. These kids don't really have any say in what's going on. Of course, their parents will just do whatever the government suggests, whatever is put to them as, you know, appropriate. And of course, the foster carers are being paid a substantial amount to take care of kids, so they're not going to rock the boat too much. The issue of drug experimentation on kids in orphanages and foster care is something that is absolutely shocking and has to be exposed. Gabrielle Phillips Short will be coming on at 9 p.m. if you're in U.S. Central Time, and at 2 p.m. if you're here in Australia. And she'll be going through all of that and many other aspects of the way the system is kind of just grinding these people down, turning them into fodder, turning them into a tool or a vassal or an object to be used by the state. And of course, this is the problem with the nanny state. This is the problem with socialized healthcare. And I just have to say, you know, I'm not against the idea of a safety net where we're all guaranteed a minimum amount of healthcare. I'm not against that. But unfortunately, the practice of that, which is a form of socialism, turns into, it seems in every case, it metamorphosizes into this system of exploitation. And people can't seem to see it as it's happening. It just unfolds, and people don't recognize it, and then it becomes really full-blown till we get to the sort of situation we have now, and it's impossible to roll it back. And, of course, people will object, and they'll say, oh, you're trying to, you know, unravel the wonderful healthcare system. And of course, many people complain about the healthcare system in America. And of course, you know, Michael Moore made a famous movie about it. And people compare countries like Australia and Britain to the US and say, well, isn't it great, you know, that we have this wonderful universal healthcare system. And on some levels, it's good. I mean, I can tell you, if you need to get your eyes tested in Australia, if you have a Medicare card, you can go into any optometrist and you get your eyes tested for free. I don't know why they don't apply that to other things. You can't get your teeth checked for free. You can't get your teeth cleaned for free. You can't get any dental work done for free. But for some arbitrary reason, you can go into an optometrist and get your eyes checked for free. The problem is, however, that with this type of system, there comes all of these other things that you might not really want and you might not be able to make a judgment on that you're going to be pushed into. And of course, many people on Medicare, especially older people, get pushed into so many different medications and they don't even know what they're getting. An elderly person will go to the doctor and say, look, I'm having trouble sleeping. You know, I'm feeling tired all the time. And the doctor will put them on an antidepressant. This really happens. This happens every day. Without a diagnosis, without any proper medical supervision, without a specialist being brought in, the GP will just say, oh, okay, tired, right, yeah, not sleeping properly. And then they check the boxes and they say, okay, well, we're going to put you on this little pill here. And it's an SSRI antidepressant, a psychotropic drug, which has massive amounts of side effects. By any description, it's a dangerous controlled substance. But that's the system. The system wants to sell these drugs, so it's just extremely easy to be steamrolled into taking a variety of drugs. But anyway, I am digressing a little bit from the main thrust here, which was about the effects on children, and we'll be getting into all of that in the second hour, so please do stay with us. Now, in the remainder of the first hour today, I have some really important stories to go through with you. We've got some news regarding coal seam gas in Australia, and this is actually developing into a bigger and bigger story. The government is playing some kind of what looks like a bit of a clever game here to position themselves as if they are trying to deal with a situation. Whereas at the same time, what we know is that they are facilitating the situation of gas companies riding roughshod over people's rights, coming onto people's property, drilling and interfering with the normal activities that farmers engage in, but also in the cities. Gas drilling is now moving ahead for urban Sydney. Yes, folks, believe it or not, they're actually talking about bringing in these rigs and drilling right near where hundreds of thousands of people live. And so I've got a clip here that I'm going to play to you shortly. A couple of other stories that I'm going to cover. There's been some developments in the WikiLeaks saga with British heiress Jemima Khan unfortunately turning her back on Julian Assange. And this is a pretty significant development because she was a major supporter, provided quite a lot of money, and this very public disavowal of Julian Assange while he's still locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London is an extremely serious development. And we'll get into that more during the hour. We have a Cairns Council in Australia votes to dump fluoride. Now, this is a really interesting development and really important precedent-setting one. The Cairns City Council will remove fluoride from its water supply and saying it amounts to the involuntary medication of residents. But the council says it will not be doing anything to determine if there's broad community support. And what they're basically saying is, we don't think it's appropriate to medicate the population. You know, whether or not you like it, if you like it or you don't, we don't think it's appropriate to be putting this in the water supply. And hey, you know, it's just like these people have suddenly been struck with some virus of common sense. I mean, it's so obvious, isn't it? Why would you put a medication in the water supply? Why would you universally treat someone with a medication that only some people need, if indeed they ever did need it? Like, it's completely wrong. It's completely against the correct practices of medicine. And in fact, this is what they're saying. It says here that the spokesperson for the council said, if people want to have access to fluoride, they'll need to take that up with their dentists. The decision has been made, and we think it should not be forced on people without their consent. So an incredible landmark decision there for freedom, truth, you know, and just a sensible way of going about things. So I'm really hoping that that news story kind of percolates through and has more effect on the rest of the world. We've got some news from New Zealand, and I'll get into this in more detail later. The New Zealand has a three strikes copyright infringement law, which I didn't even know about until I read this story. It slipped through in a legislation a couple of years ago, and this is one of these fine systems, threat systems, where you basically, if you're downloading, you get a warning and you get a second warning, then you get a hefty fine. Now, of course, it's very hard to actually enforce these types of laws unless the ISPs agree. The ISPs essentially become the policemen of these type of intellectual property enforcement laws, and that's actually what's happened in New Zealand. Of course, New Zealand being a very small country, very easy to control, and we've seen a nanny state legislation is rampant in New Zealand. I mean, we've seen pressure from the government to force women who are on benefits to go on birth control. I mean, this has really happened in New Zealand. They're basically saying women who are on benefits shouldn't be allowed to have babies because they're probably not going to be good parents. We had the carbon tax go through in New Zealand even before Australia without hardly a ripple of protest. New Zealand, unfortunately, is a very oppressed country in my feeling. And I'd like to get into more about the subject of the three strikes law after we go to break. There's been a huge find of oil in Australia, and up to 233 billion barrels of oil has been discovered. Now, I do believe it's shale oil, but this is going to make a huge difference to our future and the trading future of Australia. And I'll be bringing you a speech by Anne Bressington on Agenda 21. Anne Bressington, Australian MLC. We'll be right back after the break with Truth News Radio. Don't go away. Getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Like they want us to be afraid, man. Or maybe we just like being afraid. Maybe we just so used to it at this point that it's just a part of us, part of our culture. Security alert on orange. It's been on orange since 01, G. I mean, what's up, man? Can a brother get yellow, man? Just for like 2 months or something? Goddamn. Sick of that. Mic check. The groove is thick, so I'ma rhyme like a lunatic. I do this shit with an unassuming wit. The corporation conjured up the bass and the tempo. My name is Liv, that's the intro, now let's go. The flow of life growing strife into the mix, to the pink, dark condition and the word.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, broadcasting to you on the Logos Radio Network. And for all those loyal fans of the Logos Radio Network out there, I'd just like to encourage you to visit the Logos Radio website. Just put Logos Radio Network into Google, you'll get there very quick. And look, they're trying to raise some money. They've got they run on the smell of an oily rag. It's a tough operation, and it's incredible what they've achieved. But obviously, a lot of things could be done a lot better, and they're trying to raise money for improvements in infrastructure and equipment. So, if you can get over there and put some money in, it would be great. I would certainly appreciate it because I want Logos Radio Network to go on and become a fantastic, long lived radio network too. So, just moving ahead with Truth News Radio's stories for today, let's turn to the coal seam gas topic. Now, we did a big interview on that a couple of weeks ago, and Wanda came on the show. Wanda, activist, New South Wales anti-coal seam gas activist group. Her group, mainly based in the north of New South Wales, there are activist groups opposing coal seam gas right across the country. There are ones in Sydney. There are ones in the Blue Mountains. They're in Victoria. This is a large protest movement, and I'll tell you what, the government has listened, and this is why it's important to understand that protest does work, right? The main problem with most protest groups is they never get over a certain threshold, and the government just completely ignores anything that's below a certain threshold. Coal seam gas protest movement is huge. The government is paying attention to it. Now, the Australian Labor government, the federal government, actually has a minister for the environment. And his name is Burke, I believe, Brian Burke. Sorry, Tony Burke. And I'm actually going to play to you a clip here of Tony Burke being interviewed from earlier today. I'll just give you a quick background. This is from an article on the ABC News website. A row is brewing between the federal and New South Wales governments over the exploration and exploitation of coal seam gas in urban and regional centres. The federal government has given New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell a week to explain how he plans to address community concerns. Federal Government Minister Tony Burke is demanding a New South Wales reconsider its policy and has intimated he may intervene. But he admits he is not sure how much power he has to impose stricter standards. Federal Independent Member Tony Windsor extracted a deal for environmental research into the effects of coal seam gas mining in return for supporting Labor's mining tax. Now he says New South Wales has played games with that and put up some Mickey Mouse protocols. So, look, there's a lot of argy-bargy going on within the government, and different wings of the government are kind of yelling at each other and pointing the finger of blame at each other. Why? Because there are hundreds of thousands of people protesting against this evil technology which is invading people's lives, destroying people's quality of life. I suspect that the government departments are playing a bit of a game. They're playing a bit of a blame game with each other. And while they're doing that, and while they're finger-pointing, the gas company is just going to keep on doing what they do best. They're just going to keep on drilling. I do feel that this is a giant smokescreen, but I'm going to play to you a clip here from the Environment Minister, Tony Burke, being interviewed on ABC television earlier today. And he's actually, I've just started it somewhat in the middle, where he's referring to some of the more shocking possible outcomes of gas drilling in built-up urban areas.
At the core of this issue is not every consideration hits federal environmental law. So if you live in the suburbs of Western Sydney and the groundwater is extracted and you get subsidence and it goes down, your land goes down by, say, a metre, if something like that were to happen, it's not going to affect an endangered species. But it is a genuine community issue on the impact on someone's home, a house, a school, a hospital or a road. They are important issues that have to be dealt with at the state level. So what we said was, we'll pay for the science. We'll put the money on the table to make sure the science can be done independently of the company to make sure that this all checks out okay. And what New South Wales are saying is they won't allow that scientific information to apply to every occasion. Now, why would they want to avoid using the best quality scientific information?
Is this also about shoring up support in those key battleground seats in Western Sydney where the election in September may be decided?
I think it gets right to the core of, do we think that Barry O'Farrell should have an obligation to make sure that where people are living in an area, that the impact of withdrawing a heap of water from underground is taken account of? It's that simple. Because one of the things we know, if you remove the deep underground water, which is what you have to do for coal seam gas, then there is a significant risk of subsidence, of the land falling. Now, if that happens in a forest, it can have minor impacts. If it has in farmland, it can have significant impacts. If it happens in a settled urban area, it can have catastrophic impacts. And I do not see how New South Wales can be the one state that goes into these areas and wants to avoid the scientific rigour.
Will New South Wales now miss out on the federal funding for scientific assessments?
In the letter I sent to Barry O'Farrell yesterday, I gave them 7 days to reply. I'm not prejudging where we land before I get that reply, but can I say we are not ruling out any of our options.
So that is a threat to the New South Wales government that they could miss out on, is it $50 million in funding?
That's one of the issues on the table right now.
I'll just leave it there. New South Wales government could miss out on some funding for some research. How terrible. You know, aren't they bad? And aren't I good? Here I am trying to promote this scientific study, and they're not doing it right, and they're going to miss out. Look, that's got nothing to do with the concerns of the people who are in the direct path of these drilling rigs. And by the way, the subject matter that he's referring to there as the subject of the study is only one small part and a tangential part of the concerns of the people who are against coal seam gas. Of course, land subsidence is a horrendous outcome, but what about all the health issues? What about the contamination of the water and the air we breathe? Surely that's even far more important, and he didn't even mention that. They are skirting around it. They're skirting around it with a diversionary tactic that's not even real, because it's going to be, well, the New South Wales government says this, we say that, you know, you're really bad, blah, 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 wah, 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 and nothing will happen. Government might change, there'll be more arguments, more finger-pointing, and, of course, it's all just continued business as usual. So, on the one hand, it's great that the protest movement against coal seam gas has led to this, but on the other hand, they're not really doing anything. So we have to understand that the pressure has to be continuous, relentless, and it has to get stronger and stronger. This coal seam thing is really huge, folks, and it's bad enough that I wouldn't live anywhere near a place where that was going on. I would definitely not. But, you know, not everyone can move. Not everyone's can afford it. People have families. People have investments. And it really breaks my heart to see that people's lives could be so destroyed, that they could be so lowered and indignified in this way, to be just forced to be poisoned and have no say in it. It's a very tragic situation. And I don't believe that it is something that is happening everywhere in the world. I think it is something that seems to be afflicting certain countries, certain members of the modern, highly industrialized West. I haven't heard much about coal seam gas in Asia, very densely populated areas there. I don't know. It may be happening, and I'll try and investigate that for you. But we in our countries really are being subjected to an incredible abuse of our human rights, and we have to stand up for ourselves. Now, just moving on, I mentioned earlier about Julian Assange running into some more trouble. Of course, Julian Assange still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Now, unfortunately, we are going to break, and I will have to continue with that after the break. Jemima Khan, the heiress and wife of the famous cricketer Imran Khan, has turned her back on Julian Assange. So we'll continue with that right after the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Please stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's awesome to be with you today, going through some really important stories affecting Australia and the world. And do check us out on the internet if you have a chance. Go to truthnews.com.au, have a look at our website, have a look at our podcasts. And we publish them every show, and the Logos Radio Network also publishes our podcasts. If you want them real quick, you can get them off the Logos site. And you can find the links to that on the Truth News site by just clicking on Archives in the menus. Now, returning to the subject here about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, Jemima Khan turns her back on Julian Assange. British heiress Jemima Khan has become the latest defector from the WikiLeaks camp, declaring that Julian Assange risks becoming Australia's version of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. The former wife of cricket superstar turned Pakistani politician Imran Khan has been a high-profile supporter of Mr. Assange and was one of the people who put up $30,000 to ensure his bail. She lost that money now that he jumped bail and is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy. And she has said in the New Statesman that her journey with Mr. Assange has gone from admiration to demoralization. She writes that she wanted to stand up for free speech, but she says Mr. Assange has let his rock star status go to his head. I don't regret putting up bail money for Assange, but I did so that he would be released while awaiting trial, not so that he could avoid answering to allegations. Wow. Well, this is a significant development for poor old Julian. They're locked up without sunshine, without any access to fresh air, without even a balcony. He's in a pretty tough spot there in the Ecuadorian embassy, and I'm beginning to have fears that it may not end up well for him. The media has been slowly but relentlessly assassinating Julian Assange for the last little over 2 years. Since the end of 2010, when the allegations about sexual assault were first raised, the media around the world, of all different stripes, all the different branches of the global media cartels, have taken turns in sticking the knife into Julian Assange. So look, he must have done something right. He must have done something good. You know, I had certainly had some doubts about him, as did many people. But the mere fact, the vitriol that is actually now being thrown in his face, the relentless, poisonous attacks on his character indicate that he must have done something quite serious. He must have struck a blow for truth and freedom, because they're determined to exterminate Julian Assange. And the latest effort, apart from this story here we have with the high-profile Jemima Khan, is a movie that has been released, or is shortly to be released, which Julian Assange has called a massive propaganda attack. Now, this is a Hollywood film which purports to tell the story of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And it turns out that it's a giant propaganda hoax. Julian Assange says it is lie upon lie. It's a massive propaganda attack on WikiLeaks and the character of my staff. Mr. Assange blasted the movie also for implying that Iran was working on a nuclear bomb. He said that the opening scene was set inside a military complex in Iran with documents containing nuclear symbols. How does this have anything to do with us? Indeed, well, I'll tell you how it does, Julian. They're basically, Hollywood is another arm of the New World Order. It is another arm of the objectives of those who believe that they are the oligarchs. They believe they are the rulers of this earth. And, you know, they've got their finger in every pie. They've certainly got a large finger in Hollywood. And they can drum up propaganda with Hollywood movies very, very easily. I've seen so many of them that are so obviously thinly veiled propaganda. And it really makes you wonder, doesn't it, about what these movie studios really are. I mean, they can be so easily co-opted, and they sometimes even get big actors involved. And sometimes people even think that they're a good movie. I mean, people actually don't realize that this is just sick. This is just manipulating you. It's just being done in a slick way. It's sick and it's also slick. And I think the slickness of it tends to mask the sickness of it, because really it's crass, it's ugly, it's crude. And so many of the movies that have come out since the Iraq War have had this quality about them. They're all little apologias for US military involvement. And they always have some little token demonstration that America's doing bad things. But then they always have these guys who are good guys who are trying to do their job. And they're always like really traumatized, like you know, the movie Green Zone and Hurt Locker, a couple of those that I've seen. I mean, you know, these are propaganda flicks. They're just a little bit couched. They're a little bit nuanced so that it's not too obvious. But to me, that just makes it all too obvious. You know, you can just see the hand of the editorial, the hand of the spin masters pushing the hand of the script writers. And unfortunately, this latest movie that's coming out about Julian Assange, which is to be released by DreamWorks Studios, is just more of the same. And it is going to really hurt Julian Assange. Incidentally, the director is the director who did the final two installments of the Twilight Vampire saga. So, you know, as you can see, we're not dealing with a small budget operation here, and we're dealing with big players. And, you know, it probably will be done in a way that manipulates people, and a lot of people will fall for it. Sadly, until we get a larger groundswell, until we cross a threshold at which people just refuse to listen to propaganda, refuse to take it in, can see it immediately for what it is. And of course, you know, just getting back to Julian Assange, the real issue here, the real critical issue for the future of human civilization is how he has been stripped of his rights. I mean, and I mean for the future of democratic freedom, democracies dating back since the Magna Carta. Julian Assange has been stripped of his basic rights. The right to a fair trial, innocent until proven guilty, habeas corpus. He's been denied some of the most fundamental tenets of the British justice system. You cannot lock someone up without a trial. He hasn't even been charged with anything. He hasn't actually been charged. He's merely the subject of allegations. And those who have pushed the allegations have refused to take it to the formal status of charges because they know that the whole thing would fall apart. And yet, because of a loophole in European law, the Swedish prosecutors were allowed to issue an extradition warrant to a man in the UK who's never been charged with anything, and even the allegations that are made against him do not constitute anything more than a misdemeanour. Despite all that, due to this loophole in law, Julian Assange was allowed to be extradited. And of course he had to oppose that. It's a matter of principle. And he had some high status supporters like Jemima Khan. But he's losing his support. And as he loses his support, we're losing our freedom and we're losing our democracy. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It is great to have your company today, and do stay with us for the second hour of today's show, where we are getting into the subject of foster care, orphanages, the nanny state, and the exploitation of children, with our guest Gabriel Phillips Short, who has organised a National Day of Action for Australia's Forgotten Children. And that's a rally that will be going on around the country to raise awareness of all the issues that affect children who are under care in Australia. Now, I've got a few more quite significant topics to cover here in the last section of today's show. First person has been fined under the New Zealand Three Strikes Law. As I mentioned earlier, the New Zealand Copyright Tribunal has made its first ruling under the Three Strikes Copyright Infringement Law, fining a New Zealand resident $616.57 for sharing two songs online. The decision is the one of 12 that have been before the newly created Copyright Tribunal, all of which were brought by the Recording Industry Association of New Zealand. Now, this law, which was passed in 2011, sees copyright owners send evidence of alleged infringement to internet service providers, which investigate and issue notices to the account holder. On the receipt of the third infringement notice, the copyright holder can then pursue the account holder through the Copyright Tribunal for damages of between $275 and $15,000. Well, it's all very straightforward, isn't it? You know, it's all just justice and the long arm of the law, and you shouldn't do things that are naughty, right? Is that right? Well, let's have a look at it. Let's take a closer look. First of all, let's have a look at the concept of the claim that a copyright violation has occurred. Now, the way in which these infringements are detected is through the use of peer-to-peer BitTorrent file sharing services. And I'll just read to you some more from the article here that explains a bit more in depth. The organization responsible for enforcing this, and it's the Recording Industry Association of New Zealand, RIANZ for short, sent its first notice to Telecom NZ regarding infringement of a track. And this was a Rihanna track being uploaded on the BitTorrent file sharing service uTorrent. Now, they sent the infringement notice in November 2011. Then they sent a second notice in June 2012. And the third notice came in July 2012. Although, the third notice was for a different song, it wasn't for the same song. The customer said in a letter to the tribunal that she was aware of downloading the first track, but was not aware it was being shared with other users through uTorrent multiple times. She denied sharing the second track. The tribunal said that on the evidence, file sharing had occurred via the customer's account, and on that basis, she must pay a fine. Now, here is where we've really got to subject this to some very intense questioning and analysis to understand what is really going on here. BitTorrent works with fragments of files. You do not upload or download a file. You upload data, which is tracked by what is called a seed. A seed or a tracker collates all the fragments of files to assemble a file. When people are prosecuted under the law that's in New Zealand and other similar laws that have been proposed in other countries, they're not actually being prosecuted for downloading at all. They're actually being prosecuted for uploading. But they're not uploading a file, they're just uploading data. It might be a tiny fragment of the file. Because the person at the other end is collecting all those fragments from multiple other users. However, let's go into it a little deeper. What do we mean when we say a person? All we know is that certain data is being uploaded from a certain computer. So there is no way to know what is going on with an individual. You could, I guess, compare that to a traffic infringement where a ticket is issued, and because the car has been identified, it doesn't mean that the person has been identified. But let's look at the nature of the actual crime, because it is an infringement and it is like a speeding fine. It is like a variety of other infringements in our society, which can end up in the courts, and you can end up with criminal convictions if you don't pay the fines. In some cases, you can end up in prison if you don't pay the fines. So why is all this happening? Because a person has allegedly infringed copyright. So what does that actually mean? Well, it means that they have distributed without permission something that is owned. But it's not like theft, is it? It's not the same as theft. If you actually steal something, you're not sort of distributing something on a wide basis. You're actually taking it away from someone. So copyright infringement is a quite different and quite nuanced concept that really is not like theft at all. Now, since it's not theft, how do we know that it's actually bad? I mean, this is a really important question, because the industry likes to conflate theft with copyright infringement. So the people in their minds think it's the same thing, and everyone knows that stealing is bad. But when you look at the actual facts and you look at the laws, you see they're not. They're quite distinct. So copyright infringement is not theft. It's something that it's a construct, it's a concept that has been created. And it's created and enforced by those who have all the power and all the money and control large amounts of the economy. They think it's great. And guess what? These laws really enhance their power. But they don't necessarily want you to think that or know that. So they put it to you that these laws, well, it's about theft, which it's not. They also say it's about protecting the rights of musicians, protecting the rights of the poor struggling songwriter. Well, but of course, the poor struggling songwriter has always been screwed by these record companies and continues to be. And they decide what they want to promote. It doesn't matter about the quality. It doesn't matter whether people like it. It's all just what they want. So, and it's also extremely hard, extremely unlikely that a poor struggling songwriter will ever make any money, because it's just a tiny, tiny few, and they're the select few who are promoted by the big powerful record companies. So this poor struggling songwriter whose song might be ripped off, are we really protecting him? I don't think we are, because you know what? The poor struggling songwriter wants his stuff to be seen because he wants to be known. And it's actually in his interest to put stuff up. And I know some of them do buy into this, and it's really unfortunate because they don't even understand that they're actually victims of the brainwashing of the record companies, that they think that, oh, yes, oh, they're protecting me, and oh, I'm really important, I'm really special, and I don't want people downloading my songs off the internet, and everyone's going to have to pay. Unfortunately, this is the level to which the brainwashing has worked on people, that the poor struggling songwriters themselves are deeply brainwashed and are victimized but aren't even aware of it. Because the best thing to do if you're a poor struggling songwriter is to get your stuff out, right? Get known, build up your profile. Then, you know what? All these opportunities will start to develop because you're good and people love you. And that's what the internet is there for. And, you know, people only share stuff that they like, right? So if someone finds something they like and they share it, it's only good. Like, there is no bad from that. It is not a bad thing. So again, coming back to this idea of infringements and why people should be fined, it's just about enforcing the power and consolidating the power of the oligarchs who already have all the power. But it's a complex argument in some ways, and I have had many long and fruitless discussions with some people who just don't get it, and they just say, no, it's all about protecting my rights, and, you know, you can't do that because it's wrong or it's theft. And look, copying files digitally has zero cost involved in it. It's not like pressing records. It's not like making magnetic tape. It's not like any other form of production of a commodity that exists in the physical world. Until the creation of digital formats like MP3, music could only be distributed via hard media. You know, we had records. And we had piano scrolls in the old days, you know. We had records. Then magnetic tape came in. Then cassette tape came in. Then CDs came in. And they all made it easier and quicker. But then once we got to the purely digital format, it was possible to simply copy and paste. And so there is no production cost of copying files. So there is no logic, rhyme, or reason to say that doing so should be enforced. In other words, to legitimize or restrict the rights of people to do that. It is totally free. You're not hurting anyone else financially by doing it. You're not stealing anything from anyone. It's a very complex subject. I would love to get into it in more depth. Unfortunately, we've used up this whole show, and I didn't even get to bring you Anne Bressington's speech about Agenda 21. I will hope to do that next week, but we're going to have to go to break now, and when we come back from break, we'll have our guest on talking about foster care and child abuse in Australia. Do stay with us.